You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with a debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including local protests against the Trump administration, concerns about surveillance by law enforcement agencies, and an attempt to revive the wool industry in far northern California. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Roman Battaglia, science, energy, and politics reporter.
I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And Jane, let's start with you. You covered one of the No Kings protests that happened last Saturday in Medford. For anyone who has been living under a rock, remind us what that protest was about.
Yeah, so it was part of a nationwide demonstration that took place called No Kings, basically pushing back against the Trump administration and what organizers say is an increasingly authoritarian direction taken by the administration, what they say is the militarization of our democracy. And so there were these protests planned all across the country, all across our region, on the same day that President Trump had a military parade in Washington, D.C., which was celebrating the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army and his own birthday.
Okay. Well, what was the protest like here in Medford?
Yeah, so I went to the one in Medford. As I said, there were a ton in our region and across the country. Just in our region alone, there were protests in Roseburg, Bandon, Eureka, Mount Shasta, Redding, Gold Beach, Klamath Falls.
Where wasn't there a protest?
Exactly. I've got a way longer list that I won't bore you with all of them, but there were a lot of protests in our region and, as I said, across the country. In Medford, overall, it was quite positive. Some people brought bubbles. They were blowing bubbles. They had American flags. There were a lot of signs, as there always are at protests. Some of them said, "No king in my country, abolish ICE." There was one that said, "Eggs are expensive because all the chickens are in Congress."
A little sense of humor there.
Yep. And it was super loud. There were a ton of people there. They lined both sides of East McAndrews Road in Medford for over half a mile. So really, really packed, beautiful day. There were some counter protesters who drove by, and there was some yelling from the crowd about that. But overall, It was peaceful. I didn't see any clashes. I didn't see any police there, actually. There were also some protesters who drove by in cars themselves with signs or paint on their cars. So if people didn't want to, you know, sit or stand on the sidewalk or weren't able to, there were some people who were just driving back and forth and sort of participating that way. There were a lot of people playing musical instruments and drums and tambourines and families and children and older adults. So people of all ages were there. And I talked to a protester, Paul Heward from Ashland, and I was asking him about his goal for the protest.
I want the president and his minions to see that small town America can't stand him anymore. It's one thing to have protests like this in an urban area. People that do political planning, they pretty much anticipate that there's going to be a large turnout. This is deep ruby red Jackson County. And there are thousands of people out here saying Donald Trump has got to go.
So you can kind of hear the cheering and the honking happening in the background. A lot of people were honking driving by. So I've been covering quite a few protests recently against this administration in recent months, and I'm sure there will be more that we'll keep covering.
Well, thanks, Jane. Justin, you had a story about privacy concerns over surveillance methods used by Southern Oregon law enforcement. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this anonymous group, Information for the Public, released hundreds of pages of emails between various police departments in Southern Oregon. And that group is pretty critical of surveillance from local police. They've previously released records and criticized Rogue Valley officers for using social media, actually, to kind of monitor protest activity, especially around 2020, so some time ago. But this latest document dump mostly shows an email thread between an informal group called the Southern Oregon Analyst Group from 2021 to 2024. And this informal group was made up of a number of Southern Oregon crime analysts, as well as people from federal agencies like the FBI and ICE. And a lot of this communication had to do with departments describing what kind of programs and tech they used for investigating crime. And then analysts also offer their services to counterparts in other departments.
So police sharing tips and offering resources to each other, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, that's the thing. So law enforcement would say nothing. You know, these analysts go after crimes like missing persons or human trafficking, illegal cannabis grows. So sometimes some, you know, pretty serious crimes that you know, most residents would want investigated. But one thing that this group, Information for Public Use, as well as the ACLU of Oregon, takes issue with is the potential for casual sharing of services with federal agencies. And there's this one instance which happened in 2021 where an agent with ICE's Homeland Security Investigations team asked Medford Police for a license plate check. ICE wanted information on a suspect. And what we see in the emails, at least in the emails, is a very casual, you know, hey, can you run these plate numbers, which the Medford analyst did. And this is worrying for ACLU of Oregon because Oregon has sanctuary state laws. And those laws prohibit local agencies from helping investigate federal laws like immigration without a warrant. I spoke to Kelly Simon with ACLU. Here's her.
When we see such casual sharing without oversight, without questions about why one agency may need information from another, we start to see that our shields and our sanctuaries become more like sieves.
Well, what did the Medford Police Department have to say in response?
So Medford Police say that that request from ICE didn't have to do with an immigration-related crime, which might make sense because this was ICE's Homeland Security team. Medford Police, as well as Jackson Sheriff's Office, we did a story on this some months ago. They say that they'll continue to follow state laws, state sanctuary laws, meaning that ICE needs a warrant for information from those departments. But the problem, you know, some see is that if federal agencies don't go through official channels and instead are using email threads or these informal groups, then that can kind of be a backdoor to violating sanctuary laws. And there was actually a story in CalMatters recently that found law enforcement agencies in Southern California violated their state sanctuary laws more than 100 times last month by sharing information from these automated license plate readers with ICE.
And you're mentioning automated license plate readers quite a bit today and in your story. What are those exactly?
Yeah, it's an increasingly, you know, used and important technology for local law enforcement. So it basically records everyone's license plate if they drive in front of a camera with this has access to this program. And then it pings law enforcement if a license plate they're looking for is red. So they might have a list of license plates that they're looking for, suspects. And then it'll let law enforcement know if that car drives in front of the camera. The big company here is called Flock, and privacy proponents have criticized that company, Flock, for its ability to act as kind of like a dragnet of surveillance in areas. So they're recording everyone that goes in front of these cameras. And there's been cases also when this program has been abused by officers, like, you know, stalking their exes and doing things that are illegal. But, you know, Flock is just one surveillance technology that Medford's using. They have a lot of other programs, including some AI-assisted programs to identify suspects and collect evidence. Hundreds of private properties also participate in the city's, it's called the SCAM program. It's a security camera registration and mapping program. That's what that stands for, which allows officers to access those cameras on private property. And, you know, it's important to note that this technology is often used to investigate serious crimes. So, you know, not necessarily a bad thing. But what I think is interesting is just the level of surveillance being used at the local level. And usually when people are concerned about surveillance and privacy, they're thinking the federal level. But a lot of these local law enforcement agencies, they're really at the forefront of surveillance technology.
Well, certainly an interesting story, Justin. Thank you so much. Roman, you kind of had our moment of joy this week. You brought us the story of a wool spinnery on the Northern California coast. First, why did you do this story, Roman? Are you into yarn?
I am into yarn. I am into wool. I love wool.
Okay.
But I actually learned about this because I was working on another story down in Eureka, the story about the Hall of Simulation at Cal Poly Humboldt, which I published a week or two ago. And so I was like, well, I might as well go visit while I'm down here because this new wool spinnery is, you know, being opened here in Humboldt County. So I didn't really know anything about the history of the wool industry. It was really fascinating to kind of learn more about the history there in Humboldt County and see all of these machines. It was in this like former garage space in this really, 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 really tiny town called Fernbridge, which is south of Eureka. And there's all these different machines that go into making wool. And it's a really complicated process that involves a lot of different spinning and combing and raking and steaming and all these sorts of different things that they're doing. And it's really cool, but it ends up looking really beautiful. And, you know, the people there really take care of their work, Kate and Sean Edwards, who are the owners, because I felt some of the yarn and it was really, really soft and amazing. So I, you know, I want to tell more people about this, you know, interesting new wool spinnery and their efforts to kind of bring back the wool industry.
Yeah, and there's also a historical connection. What did you learn about the wool industry in Humboldt County? It sounds like it really used to just be thriving there.
Yeah, oh yeah. Apparently, you know, wool used to be a really, really huge industry in Humboldt County. So settlers had kind of started coming here in the 1800s, and they had to figure out the best crops and livestock to grow there. Turns out sheep do really, really well in that climate. And then there were also a lot of Basque immigrants coming to that area. That's an area on the border of France and Spain. So here is Kate Edwards from the Lost Coast Spinnery explaining why these Basque immigrants were important for the wool industry in Humboldt County.
They are known as some of the best sheep herders in the world. They'll run thousands of head. This is one of the things they are known for. So if you could afford to have a Basque shepherd, you were swimming in tall cotton, or however they say it. So a lot of them moved here because of the climate. The area was open. It wasn't really crowded. They could have their flocks feed without having any grains.
Yeah, so wool kind of took over the county starting in the late 1800s. Around a third of the land was dedicated to sheep grazing in the county. It's a lot. It's a lot of land.
Yeah.
I was looking through some old historical photos, and you can just see these like massive flocks of sheep just taking over hillsides, you know, eating everything in sight. they exported, I think at their height, they were exporting like 500,000 pounds of wool a year from Humboldt County.
That's a lot of sweaters.
Yeah, I know it is. and also, you know, back then, you know, wool was one of the main fabrics. I mean, you had cotton and you had wool. Like, that was one of the two main fabrics you would wear for clothing. So it was much bigger. There's also this big mill in Eureka that processed a lot of it. But, you know, eventually the rise of synthetic fabrics like polyester and stuff, and then also outsourcing wool processing to other countries like China and stuff, meant there was less demand locally for wool. Kate had also told me that another reason was that during World War II, the GIs were sent a lot of lamb to eat. And then they got sick of eating it because they were eating a lot of it. And so then when they came back home, they didn't want to eat any more lamb. And so less lamb, growing less lamb means less sheep, which means less wool.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was just kind of a funny coincidence that also happened there. And so now, though, we're seeing kind of this resurgence of these small and medium-sized mills like Kate's. They're kind of catering to these small ranchers with just a few sheep, or luxury fashion brands who want more humanely sourced wool and, you know, humanely sourced wool processing. I know that I talked about in the story on the website that Ralph Lauren produced these locally sourced wool from Central Oregon to produce the Team USA outfits for the Paris Olympics.
So whenever you see that on TV, you can take some local pride, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like you learned a lot of interesting things. What else did you learn that you weren't able to include in your story that I probably cut?
I know. There was so much stuff, and she was just a big talker and loved talking about wool, so I learned so many things. But, you know, one thing that was interesting was about how, you know, different wool can be depending on the circumstances and how it's grown. Like, you know, the different types of sheep, their feed, their location can all kind of change how the wool feels and how it's processed. Here's Kate Edwards again describing how experts can use wool to identify what kind of sheep it came from.
One of the things about learning this business over the years is a guy that I was following in England, who's a master classer, you can pick up a fleece and touch it and smell it and listen to it and almost tell if the animal was sick. Did it lamb that year? Is it a wether? Is it an older ram? Just by the quality of the fleece and how it feels and how it sounds, we're listening for a snap.
So that was really interesting that they can tell like where the lamb come. I even talked about like we started talking about Icelandic wool, and she was talking about the differences and why Icelandic wool is scratchier than other wool and stuff, and like all the differences.
She sounds like a wool sommelier.
I know, yeah. And she told me she was like, I don't knit. She doesn't knit at all. She's like, I can't knit. My husband does all the knitting.
Oh, funny.
So I didn't know a lot about it, and that was really interesting. I also learned about yak fiber and how it's really hard to process. They do other kinds of fiber like alpaca and yak. Apparently, yak fiber is really soft and fine, like down, but it's so light they have to like close all the doors and wear masks to avoid letting it escape because it'll just fly away, and it's really hard.
Wow.
They got to keep track of all of it.
So I need
really
to check
precious.
Out yak fiber like sweaters
apparently,
or something.
Apparently, yeah. And Plus, you know, they're also really struggling. I mean, they're running on a margin of only about 10%, which is really low, and the cost of the machines and the cost to fix them is hard. So, but they're not really doing it for the money, and I think that was what was interesting. They really want to support these small ranchers with more affordable options to process their wool.
Well, thanks so much, Roman, for covering, bringing us a little bit more about wool.
Yeah.
That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform.